Hey y'all. So when it comes to bodies, weight loss is not really something that I'm pursuing right now. But as you know, one of Vanessa's family members has been taking a GLP-1 medication, and it's worked really well for him. So if that is part of your journey, you should check out the Row Body Program. Row provides access to the most popular weight loss shots on the market. Row's partner handles all the insurance paperwork to help get the medication covered. If eligible for medication, patients have access to their provider on demand for any questions. Go to ro.co/infamous. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/infamous.
Campsite Media.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining Infamous again this week. I'm Natalie Robomet. So we're going to be talking about one of the most indelible 1% scandals of the past decade, the Varsity Blues case.
That's Georgetown, Boston College, Georgia Tech, USC, UCLA, Berkeley.
But she's not a terrific student. She's been testing very badly.
If you don't remember it, back in the 2010s, a bunch of upper-class helicopter moms and dads from California paid a college consultant to get their kids into college by pretending the kids were athletes, like really good tennis players or equestrians. One guy was behind it all. His name was Rick Singer. He was this kind of spry, athletic-looking guy with salt-and-pepper hair and an etched face, who looked like he spent a lot of time running in the sun. Which, in a funny way, he did, because even though Rick was making millions, he actually lived out of his Sprinter van, driving up and down the West Coast. Rick figured out the college coaches often get a pass from admissions offices. Like, they could just tell an admissions officer at Georgetown or wherever, hey, I want this kid because he's a good athlete, and no one ever checks at admissions if he is a good athlete. And recruited athletes are way more likely to get in. For example, at Harvard, over the course of 6 years, recruited athletes had an 85% acceptance rate. So Rick Singer colluded with college coaches to get rich people's kids into fancy schools under the guise of being athletes. And the rich parents paid him handsomely for it.
In the midst of her college application process, this 21-year-old says her mother got a call from Rick Singer.
He asked her what my grades were. He asked her what my ACT score was. She told him, and he said, oh, those aren't getting her into Ivy Leagues. He goes, oh, well, you know, is she athletically involved in any way? Is she a star athlete? And my mom says, this girl can't play anything. She's terrible at athletics. And he kind of just said, oh, it won't be a problem.
When they got to college, the kids just never joined the teams. But by then, they were at USC or Georgetown, so all was well, and their parents were happy. Until those parents were arrested.
Your mom's been in prison for a few weeks.
Yeah.
Your dad just went.
Yes.
How's that been?
It's been hard. I think for anybody, no matter what the situation is, you don't want to see your parents go to prison.
There were a lot of major C-suite parents and celebrities involved, like Felicity Huffman from Desperate Housewives and Lori Loughlin from Full House. Some of them were woken up early in the morning on the day they were arrested and had guns pointed at them. There were tons of lawsuits and a few went to jail. But there's so much more to the story, from the surprising origins of how the case was uncovered to Rick Singer's SAT score scam. Today, Vanessa is talking to the prosecutor in the Varsity Blues case to tell us all about it. His name is Eric Rosen.
So tell me how you got involved in the Varsity Blues case.
Sure. Like many things in life, it came out of nowhere, and it was both a mix of, you know, luck and sort of pluck. Effectively, I had moved into securities and financial fraud unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston in 2017. I was assigned a case involving what's known as a pump and dump scheme that was being run out of Switzerland, actually. But it's very difficult to investigate people in Switzerland. So the way we decided to do it was investigate someone who owns and operates stock that they then will give to the pump and dump guy. So this guy was Canadian, but he actually lived in LA. His name is Maury Tobin. And we investigated Maury Tobin for a while about various stocks that he was defrauding people with.
Maury Tobin. I mean, what a name.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's you're picturing a guy. I think there was a movie, maybe it was in Goodfellas or something like that. Maury, you know, he had a toupee. He had, you know, sort of an overweight late 50s, early 60s guy, sort of a schlump. This Maury Tobin is very different. He was probably late 50s, extremely good physical condition, tan, relaxed, looked like he was, you know, 20 years younger, smooth talking, had sort of a Montreal affect in his speech, like a wholesome nature to how he talked. And you can see why he was so good at his job of conning people. And then on Valentine's Day of 2018, we executed a search warrant at his home in Los Angeles, a giant sort of mansion in the Hancock Park area. And like many people, he decided to come in a few weeks later and cooperate with me and investigators. And we did what's known as a proffer session, a contractual agreement. You come in, you tell us everything. No promises, obviously, as to what could happen, but we agree not to hold what you say against you. At the beginning of the second day, you know, we've just been talking about stock fraud, his lawyer sort of pulls us aside and said, hey, you know, there's something else going on that you may want to ask him about. And we're like, you know, what? And he's like, well, it's very difficult, involves his family, you know, his daughter. We're going around and round, and you know, eventually we sort of pull it out of him that he's been paying the Yale soccer coach a couple thousand dollars a month. And in exchange, the Yale soccer coach agreed to recruit his daughter to the Yale soccer team. We asked him, why would you be doing this? And, you know, not knowing really much about college admissions, you know, like most people, I had done it once in my life and then you sort of forget about it. He's like, because If your kid is a recruited athlete at Ivy League or elite schools, you're not guaranteed admission, but basically you rise to the head of the pack and the admissions rate jumps from 3% to, like, as long as your scores are, like, grades are decent, to like 80%. So they hadn't arrived at the real bribe amount. So that was something that we sort of exploited. And we set up a number of recorded calls between Maury and the Yale soccer coach, Rudy Meredith, in which they discussed, you know, Rudy wanted a beach house in Florida. Maury agreed to pay for it. They then made a plan to meet in a Boston hotel room, the Marriott Long Wharf. Coincidentally, I had my senior prom there, so I was well familiar with the hotel. We set up cameras and everything in the room, and, you know, we were next door. At that point, we thought it was sort of a one and done, just, you know, interesting case, Maury and the Yale soccer coach. And then at the very end of the meeting, Rudy says to Maury, he says, you know, by the way, there's this guy in L.A. He has all these coaches on his payroll and he pays them off. And in exchange, you know, he recruits these, like, fake athletes and they get them into, you know, good schools on the grounds that they're, you know, that they're recruits.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Harvard.
Ah, you went to Harvard. Okay. Were you on the water polo team?
No, definitely not. There was no fraud involved. There was no shenanigans or anything like involved. And jumping ahead a little bit, those circumstances that I just talked about were very important to how this scam operated. Because Rick Singer would exploit that, you know, the protagonist in our story, exploit parents' fears, because a lot of these parents were 30 years older than their kids, obviously, had gone to college generally in the 80s, where you sort of apply to a couple, even less, you know, three or four places. The admissions rate for a place like Georgetown was like 50%, and now it's 6%. USC was considered a place no one wanted to go. And now it's, you know, one of the most prestigious schools in the nation. And everything sort of changed. And so parents were sort of, even the most sophisticated parents, were sort of caught off guard with that. And so they relied on wealthy people, relied on people like Rick to guide their kids. And he played off those fears of your kid's not going to get in anywhere because it's so difficult. And there are a million kids who have that bio.
You know, USC, when we went to school, was a 75% acceptance, right?
Yeah.
And now they're down to like 16. And you do have to put yourself in the parents' shoes of thinking, oh my God, this is, everything is stacked against my kid. And I have to give this to my kid. So Rick sort of exploited that, right?
Oh, yeah. He definitely exploited that. I don't know if you've been to USC.
I know. I know where it is.
It's extremely, it's very beautiful. You know, all the buildings have like people's names on them in a way that's like a little bit garish. You know, obviously, you know, a place like Harvard and probably Wesleyan has like, the name is of whoever donated money 200 years ago to build the building. But it's like sort of small. It's in sort of small print. USC is like the exact, like every floor has like a billboard almost of these buildings on the outside. And you could like, it's almost, it's like this person obviously donated the money and they want to be known that they donated the money. So it's a very commercial atmosphere there. It's sort of an interesting juxtapose from East Coast schools, which I think are a little bit more, try to keep things like that a little bit more under the radar. Or at least, you know, did previously. Finishing this sort of episode of Maury, Tobin, and Rudy in the hotel room, at the very end, they're having a great time, and Maury's giving them cash, and they agree to, they actually sign a contract. It's like $400,000, like stuff you couldn't even make up. It was like in a movie, you know, of how bad these people, you know, bumbling fools of bribery were. And in the end, he's like, you know, there's this guy in LA who, this is his job. Maury's like, well, you know, who is it? I live in LA. And Rudy's like, nah, you wouldn't know him. And then eventually Maury sort of pulls it out, like, oh, there's this, yeah, his name Rick Singer. And then Rudy goes in onto this like 10-minute tangent saying, like, well, I've never worked with him, but if I did work with him, here's how I would do it. It's like OJ. I didn't kill her, but, you know, if I did, here's how it would have been done. It was hilarious because it's like, obviously you worked with the guy, you know?
Yeah.
You have thought out this master plan just by yourself. That was the first we heard of this Rick Singer. And when we got back to the office, we got Rudy's bank records back, and he had gotten like $850,000 or something from this organization first we heard of called the Key Worldwide Foundation, a nonprofit. We quickly associated that with Rick Singer. We then went from Rudy to the bank records of the Key Worldwide Foundation. And at that point, we're like, holy shit, there is a lot of money flowing through this organization for like what appears to be for no real reason. They're coming from pretty established individuals. And they're coming in huge sort of round numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also this major discrepancy between numbers. Like some people, like Felicity Hoffman, gave like $15,000 or $20,000. And then some people gave like $250,000. So we had no real idea like what's going on and why. And then we got a search warrant for Rick's computer for his Gmail.
Yeah.
Which was a bonanza of crime. And then we started going through it and this was like, wait a minute. There are like all these photos of these kids being photoshopped into fake athletes. Wow, this is his
so
job.
So crazy.
Rudy, by that point, was cooperating with us. He was confronted by FBI, and he folded in about 1 second. He was not someone who was meant for the criminal circuit. He couldn't figure out an excuse for why he had just accepted all this money. He was caught, dumbfounded, and decided confession and working would be easier. He made recorded calls to Rick Singer. And then probably mid-April, we had a wiretap, actually, of Rick Singer's phone. It was probably the quickest. Wiretaps take a long time to sort of get into a gear because it's such an intrusive process. You have to use non-intrusive methods first and then do a massive affidavit to the judge saying why you need a wiretap. It's not quite like the movies where someone thinks about intercepting a phone and like an hour later they're in a listening booth. It takes months. But we got up on a wiretap and then it was like open season. We realized quickly that the discrepancy in payments was because Rick had this other scam, not just the fake athlete, but also fake testing. and that was cheaper. You could get a fake SAT or ACT score mm-hmm. for anywhere between $20,000 and $100,000, price solely dependent on what Rick thought he could get out of you as a parent. We flew Rick to Boston under the guise that he was meeting with a Harvard coach who wanted to meet him in person to see if everything was legit. We brought him to the same hotel, the Marriott Long Wharf. He began cooperating. He actually obstructed the case for a little while, but then got back on the cooperation train and started making recorded calls to all the parents who had done it previous years. And through that, we get confessions as to what they had done previously. And ultimately, in March 12th of 2019, we took down the case and arrested about 55 people.
When you first hear about this, are you like, is this even something we can trade? It's like some really penny ante weird thing about getting into Yale. Like, who cares?
Well, you know, we thought it was a one and done. So we're like, okay, this will get a little bit of press if we do it. We only thought it would be like, okay, this is like a couple weeks of time and then we'll move on. It was later when we started getting into the, like the main media investigation of being like, wait a minute, you're doing all this to like bust parents around the country for like cheating on the SATs.
Yeah.
So that was an internal debate that we had. It was styled to be what they call an impact case, meaning like the sentencings aren't as important. It's really about sending a message that, you know, this will be taken seriously to ward off people, you know, from doing this. I was concerned, like, A, are people going to think we just wasted like a year's worth of time like doing this? B, are people going to take the side of the parents getting arrested for cheating on the ACT or SAT, something that probably happens every day, day in and day out? Are we going to become like a joke, sort of a laughing stock for, you know, having this huge press conference here about SAT, ACT cheating, fake athletes, that blah, blah, blah. And finally, we had our press conference, and I remember I was up there on stage and phone was in my breast pocket of my suit, and it was literally just vibrating the whole time. And, you know, it's 45 minutes and obviously I wasn't looking at it. And then I get off and I'm checking my messages and like, you know, it's 15 messages from friends and people I like, some people I barely knew. Like, I just saw you on CNN. That's awesome. You know, like I just realized like it went insane. Like everybody covered it. Every single person from people to Entertainment Weekly to, you know, CNN. I thought it would be like third page of the Metro section or something like that. I had no idea that it would like blow up.
It's crazy. Yeah. Well, it's the Schadenfreude, right? It's like people.
Yeah.
I mean, it just confirms what everybody feels, right, about these rich, overprivileged parents with slightly not so intellectual children, which is like, you know, they get in.
Right.
Right. They just do whatever they need to do. They pull whatever lever they need to pull. And if it's unethical, it is.
Anybody who has a sibling knows that sibling fights are unavoidable. But what if every fight you had was under a microscope, on a global scale? That's the reality for brothers Prince Harry and Prince William. They'd been each other's closest friends and allies since the death of their mother. But that all began to crack as they married and took wildly different approaches to their royal duties. Wondery's podcast, Disintel, is hosted by comedians Sydney Battle and Matt Bellassai. Each episode unpacks one of pop culture's most iconic celebrity feuds, and they recently took a deeper look into the real reason William versus Harry started. It's actually much bigger than these two brothers, stretching back into the history of the British monarchy. Did their feud start with the royal family's mistreatment of Meghan Markle? Or was it something that began much earlier? Follow Disintel on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. On each episode of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop, comedians join host Misha Brown to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question. Who thought this was a good idea? Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? When they launched their Pepsi points system, they never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
This is Infamous from Campside Media.
What's so crazy about the Varsity Blues story is it was all driven by the parents and the parents' desire for this elite college experience that a lot of them never had. It's like they were living vicariously through their kids. And I get that instinct. You want to protect your kids, but you can also project your desire to be powerful and legendary onto your kids too. Here's Felicity Huffman.
It was sort of like my daughter's future, which meant I had to break the law.
In December of 2017, actress Felicity Huffman drove her daughter to take the SAT test. Her daughter not knowing that Huffman had paid $15,000 for someone to falsify the results.
She was going, can we get ice cream afterwards? I'm scared about the test. What can we do that's fun? And I kept thinking, turn around, just turn around. And to my undying shame, I didn't. I know hindsight is 20/20, but it felt like I would be a bad mother if I didn't do it.
So just as these parents are going through this whole existential crisis, Rick shows up. He knows exactly how to play this, how to manipulate the parents' fears and regrets, their ambitions, their fantasies. He focuses on how the college admissions process is already kind of shady. I mean, everybody knows that rich kids have a huge leg up thanks to legacy and donations, but also test prep, essay coaching, private schools, all that stuff. And because the system is so broken, Rick makes what he's doing sound sort of okay.
Here's a clip from a documentary called Operation Varsity Blues that recreates Rick's conversations using voice actors.
So if you said Harvard or Princeton or Georgetown, you know, what are those things?
Well, if you want to use my side door at Harvard, it's about 1.2 million.
Jesus.
But if you want to go through the back door, Harvard's asking for 45 million.
God.
Stanford's asking for 50 million.
Wow.
And they're getting it. That's the crazy thing. They're getting it from the Bay Area and from New York. John, this is how crazy it's gotten.
I'm going to do over 730 of these side doors this year.
So what was the back door versus the side door? Like, what did he mean by those terms?
So the side door is the mm-hmm. Rick Singer door. The back door is, that's like the big donations door. That's the 25 million, the door that's currently up for debate as to what influence big donors have. But the back door, here's the thing about the back door. One, you know, the people that we were dealing with, they can't afford the back door. They're not gonna pay $30 million to donate a library
yeah,
to Harvard.
Right.
If you donate $100 million to Harvard, your kids are probably gonna get in. But it's never an explicit quid pro quo, and that's for a variety of reasons. Not only the tax reasons, but if you think about it, if you're a school guaranteeing an admissions slot for X amount of money, then you're just selling a slot. That becomes the price. Why would anybody who wanted to get in donate more than that then? So you want to keep it vague to be like, okay, well, you know, that person donated $50 million, their kids didn't get in, but if you deal $100 million. So there's incentives not to guarantee a slot for a school. The side door was different. The side door, because Rick had worked it out with all the coaches, was an explicit quid pro quo guarantee, payment of money, admission slot. You don't pay until the kid gets in.
So wait, how did that work? That was like you had to pay to Rick's charity?
Oh, yeah. You had to donate. You donate to Rick's charity. You get the tax deduction. He had the Key Worldwide Foundation. It sounds like a bad movie.
The Key. Yeah. What did he tell the IRS that was? Like helping underprivileged children or something?
Well, the IRS at that point, they were a little bit behind on the ball. He was actually filing the forms that you're required to file, the 990 forms. And so we actually pulled the 990 just like on the web. And it was like, you know, it was crazy because it went from like $10,000 in donations a year to like 15 million. Like it was the most successful charity on the face of the planet.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wait a minute, why is this coach getting money? Or why is like the USC water polo team getting money?
Yeah.
But the IRS hadn't caught up with them. Generally, the IRS works pretty slow. They have a 5-year statute of limitations and they make the most of that. So if you do engage in tax fraud, it will probably take a couple years for agents yeah. and investigators to track you down.
Why'd you guys call the case Varsity Blues?
There was a sort of an internal struggle, battle, in good jokingly, between the FBI and the DOJ.
Oh, okay.
I had named, because it started with Rudy Meredith, I opened the investigation with a soccer theme, and I called it Operation Free Kick.
Okay, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's catchy, you know. Yeah. The FBI wanted to name it Operation Varsity Blues. I'm like, that's the dumbest name I've ever heard. That's, you know, that stupid Varsity Blues movie. This is like going to be a joke.
Yeah.
But then at the press conference, the FBI guy just announced it. Like that was the name and it quickly caught on and now knowing the Operation Free Kick has been consigned to the dustbin of history. But, you know, that's one battle that I did lose as to what the name of the investigation would be.
So do you feel, you know, I think that people who don't really understand this case or don't like really haven't didn't watch it that closely, they think that it was the parents, right, who took this college counselor who was maybe like slightly shady, but they pushed him, right,
yeah.
to do these things on their behalf. But what you realize is like, if Rick hadn't like laid out the breadcrumbs, these people never would have walked down, right, the gingerbread lane.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
I divide the parents into camps of, you know, there's like criminals, parents who were, this is just one of the crimes that they committed. You know, there are other crimes that they did. And that's a very small minority of the people. Then there are like parents living and playing in the gray area, which I would say was maybe like 20-25% who enthusiastically embraced what was going on. And then there's a remainder that probably would never have gotten caught up in something like this had they not been sort of enticingly presented with this option. And, you know, whether they were pushed or whether they saw the breadcrumbs, you know, that's their own, you know, thinking. But I do think it would be a mistake to sort of paint them all with a big brush.
So then, like, Felicity Huffman has come out and said that she was awakened by the FBI, you know, held at gunpoint. Her kids were there. I mean, isn't that a little much?
They came into my home. They woke my daughters up at gunpoint. Then they put my hands behind my back and handcuffed me, and I asked if I could get dressed. And I thought it was a hoax. I literally turned to one of the FBI people in a flak jacket and a gun, and I went, is this a joke?
You know, as a defense attorney now, yeah, I mean, I wholeheartedly disagree with it. As the AUSA, I didn't have actually any say in how people would be arrested. It wasn't like I was like directing people, you know, to use guns or anything like that. Do I think it was heavy-handed? Yes, absolutely. Do I think going in there with a battering ram was for a lot of some of these places was over the top? Yeah, absolutely.
So do you think that the punishments were correct? Because in the end, they didn't get so punished, right?
Well, I think it sort of depends on how you define punishment. Nationwide mockery and shaming certainly is a punishment in my book. And again, it was an impact case. And, you know, I emphasize that a lot. But, you know, certainly the U.S. attorney made decisions to seek hefty sentences that the courts then did not impose. And I think the courts generally got it right by, I think the most someone got is like 15 months or something like that. So I think that was totally reasonable. You know, on this side, like, you know, it's hard to underestimate, you know, how terrible prison is. It's not fun for families. It's, there's no, the white collar camps are not good. They're demeaning and they're prison. It's punishment whether you're there for 2 weeks or 4 weeks is not the issue. I mean, it's a certainly, yes, less time is better, but going there at all is not a pleasant experience. And certainly none of these parents are going to reoffend in any way. I mean, I think it set the message.
I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. With Rocket Money, I have full control over my subscriptions and a clear view of my expenses. I can see all my subscriptions in one place, and if I see something I don't want, Rocket Money can help me cancel it with just a few taps. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/infamous. That's rocketmoney.com/infamous. rocketmoney.com/infamous.
Welcome to True Spies, the podcast that takes you deep inside the greatest secret missions of all time.
Suddenly out of the dark, it's appeared Bin Laden.
You'll meet the people who live life undercover. What do they know? What are their skills? And what would you do in their position?
Vengeance felt good. Seeing these people pay for what they'd done felt righteous.
True Spies from Spyscape Studios, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Infamous from Campside Media.
When the Varsity Blues news broke, it wasn't just the parents who were humiliated and ostracized. Lori Loughlin's daughter, a YouTuber called Olivia Jade, who is also reportedly Jacob Elordi's on-and-off girlfriend, discussed the fallout on Jada Pinkett Smith's Red Table Talk. Now that's a sentence.
I didn't know what she was talking about, but I was like, I'm just going to search my mom's name up. Then it's everywhere. And I was sitting with a group of friends, and I knew any second everybody was going to know, too.
If
they didn't already. And I remember just, like, freezing and feeling so ashamed. I went home and hid myself for probably, like, 3 or 4 months.
And did you go back to school, or did you decide not to return?
Yeah, I never went back. I was too embarrassed. And you know what? I shouldn't have been there in the first place, clearly. So there was no point in me trying to go back.
It seems like this probably messed the kids up much more than going to some non-top-tier college ever could have. So was this shiny, prestigious degree really that important?
Having gone to Harvard, do you feel that it gave you a big leg up in life? Like, is what these people were trying to get, was it worth it?
Yeah, well, I actually feel like being the Varsity Blues guy has given me a bigger leg up in life now.
That's right. Now you're famous.
But yeah, listen, you know, it doesn't get me like work. I still have to earn the work. And I do, you know, gets you in the door to like be there. But at the end of the day, if you don't present a compelling alternative, no one's going to be like, okay, well, that guy sucked, but I'm going to hire the Varsity Blues guy anyway. Like, people don't do that. It's sort of the same with Harvard. It's like, it helps get you in the door, particularly when like, like, my dad was an engineer. My mom worked at the VA. I sort of wanted to do other stuff, like finance. I had no, like, guidance. Like, I couldn't call my parents' friends and say, hey, like, I want an internship at your bank. Like, I didn't have that those connections at all. And, you know, going to Harvard, like, gave me that. And it gets you the credibility to, like, show up and play. Ultimately, that decreases over the course of your career. You sort of age out of it a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that for people who didn't go to, you know, a school like Harvard, it's hard not to feel like everybody has a secret key. You know, it's the Illuminati. It's this thing that, you know, I can't possibly have. And certainly if you go into a certain kind of field, if you want to be in hedge funds, right? Or some sort of investment scenario, I would think that it helps. But hard work still matters in this world. And I think where you went to college sort of becoming less and less important, right?
100%, because it's so hard to get in and such a crapshoot that people that, like, a lot of people don't care. And state schools especially have had resurgences, I think, as both in terms of quality of students that they attract, but also like honors programs within them. I mean, certainly, you know, the Harvard, Yales, Princeton's will always have their the fame, but I think you'd have to be an idiot to restrict hiring just to that, given the real quality of the kids and the fact that, like, with a 3 or 4% acceptance rate, very, very, very talented individuals are going to get rejected and
right,
they shouldn't
absolutely
be overlooked.
And I think that, you know, it's a content creator's world here, right? It's, you know, people can learn on YouTube about quite a bit of stuff, right? They don't need to be in, you know, the seminar room in the building covered with ivy with the, you know, smell of chimneys outside.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great fantasy, but you can make your way through the world.
Yeah.
And certainly people do now without that imprimatur. And, you know, to go into massive amounts of debt because of it is starting, that arbitrage is starting to seem real off, right? You know, when I went to Wesleyan, again, it was not like that hard to get in. And it was like a lot of people with ferrets. And it was just like the weird school, right? Funnily enough, I do have some sources in like the Bay Area who are very, very wealthy tech billionaire people. And I had gotten a call right when this story broke from somebody who said, you know, my friend is close with this guy, Rick. He's really a good guy. It's all the parents' fault. And I remember I tried to like land the story, but other, you know, journalists were working on it. And I was working on something else. And I just said, OK, forget it. But I had always had this thought in my mind, like, oh, maybe it wasn't him really, but obviously I followed it enough to be like, okay, that person who called me was completely wrong.
No, it was definitely him.
But he had sort. Remember, he had all those people in the like sort of in the Bay Area, right? Earlier on in his career, maybe, you know, some of them felt they should do him a solid and try to help him out. I mean, was Rick doing anything behind the scenes to try to help himself? Did he run any sort of media campaign on his behalf, or did he try to get parents to say this wasn't true?
No.
Yeah.
Because he had been cooperating at that point for six months. I mean, he definitely denied a lot of it at first, but, you know, the evidence was just absolutely overwhelming. I mean, from the calls, the recording, you know, you're up on someone's phone for 4 months. He was on the phone all the time because Rick, he wasn't living in his car, but he definitely, when he was up in the Bay Area, he would generally stay in his Sprinter van. But he did house calls. Like, he was different than, like, so he'd drive around,
so
like,
nuts.
Southern California all day in L.A., which, you know, traffic is crazy. So he'd be in his car, like, 7 hours
so
a day.
So nuts. And then he'd just pull over to the side of the road near a beach or something and sleep.
Yeah. but he had a beautiful Newport Beach home that he bought with Key Worldwide Foundation money.
Yeah, but it's fascinating to think of him as like this sort of newfangled Willie Loman, you know, selling his wares up and down the coast to all of these people who have this like sort of, you know, nouveau riche sort of wealth, but want this status for their children.
Yeah, you want the status.
And they almost want, okay, fine, it's USC, but like USC sort of looks like a fancy East Coast school. And it's like they're all chasing this illusion of this, like, oh, my child should go to one of these fancy Northeast prep school colleges and it'll just change their life and it'll make us, you know, old money-ish. It'll make us blue bloods. It'll make us feel so good. And it's just like, oh my God, what a disaster. Really fascinating. Thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate your time. And we'll be watching what you do next.
Next time on Infamous. This story only happened in 2019, but college admissions have gotten even more competitive, if you can believe it. These days, the top tier of colleges want kids who are pointy, which means that they specialize in one thing, like studying a fish that's about to go extinct, versus playing an instrument and being quarterback and valedictorian. Admissions officers are trying to create a well-rounded class, not a well-rounded student, according to a book. and it's just putting a ton of pressure on kids. And probably a lot of scams like this that we just never hear of.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code Program.